From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
My first time in Beijing, and it's been a wonderful visit so far.
Great. I'm happy to hear that.
That was Peter Laveau, the host of RT's Crosstalk, with his host, Liu Jin, from China's Global Television Network, as the pair discussed the Western media, among other things. Laveau was in Beijing for the 9th BRICS Summit, which was held at Xiamen International Conference Center. China's President Xi Jinping chaired the summit, with South Africa's President Jacob Zuma, Brazil's President Michel Temer, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi in attendance. We caught up with Peter Laveau as he arrived back in Moscow and discussed his visit and his impressions of the new media world that seems to be coming into existence. Peter, first, a pleasure to have you back, and you had quite a trip, apparently. Why don't you tell us about it?
It all kind of was a progressive revelation for me, because when they first told me they wanted me to be part of a BRICS media conference in China, I wasn't given a whole lot of details. And then a whole slew of details came to me about what they wanted to do, and I really couldn't make any heads or tails of it. But having never been to China before, I jumped at the chance, and again, to represent Russia as an American was, you know, it's still, the novelty is still there. It was certainly there for the people in Beijing.
Yeah.
It was really amazing. And what it was just the BRICS countries, all five of them, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they sent a private or state-owned media, and we had a debate on I pretty much told them what I wanted to talk about is what BRICS means in the media. Of course, other members talked about other things like security and trade and economic development. But I really going to stick with what I know best. And it was a really interesting debate. I encourage our listeners to have a look at it at the CGTN website or page on YouTube. And it was a lot of fun. I think I startled people by being myself, meaning a little aggressive at times. And and after the event, there was really very intense conversation what's going on. And there was a wide recognition of RT's success, which, of course, was nice to hear. All of the other countries want to duplicate what RT has done.
Yeah, you guys just hit 5 billion. You just hit 5 billion at YouTube, yeah. Apparently. That's amazing.
Well, you know, the interesting thing for me is that during the taping of the program and before and after, it was really this one fundamental question that was asked over and over again, just from different trajectories, is how do you guys do it? How do you do it? And my response was, is that I don't think I have a particularly sexy answer for you. There's no real secret algorithm.
Right.
There's no black magic. You know, we're not dangling trinkets in front of people's eyes. Oh, by the way, that's what Western media does.
Yeah, no kidding. The shiny object.
I just said that I think there's a conscious or a subliminal awareness, growing awareness in Western audiences that they're just being sold a sack of you know what, and I think people, because of the openness for now of the internet, people are looking elsewhere, and I think that the RT's broadcast, and certainly because you've been a frequent guest on Crosstalk, we try to say it as it is. I try to get as many points of view out there. Mm-hmm. I don't like consensus very much. As a matter of fact, people that I disagree with, I probably get more enjoyment out of talking with them.
Right.
So, and if I can just say real quickly, having seen Beijing for the first time, I was just in awe. Our listeners have to know that my impression was this. They know what they want, they know where they're going to go, and they know what they're going to get. And this, the rest of it is just white noise. I mean, this is a country on the move, very modern. I mean, except for the ethnic differences, it's the same thing. I mean, everything, the phones, the dress, the music, bustle, hustle, bustle. I was very, very impressed. And I was treated very nicely. Now, maybe because I was a recognized person, but I was treated very nicely. The Asian hospitality has always impressed me.
What was it like to speak with Liu Jin? She's quite an amazing person herself.
You know, she's got a real personality there and a real strong intellect. And yep. You have to remember that she's, you know, debating and arguing in a foreign language, which she has absolutely mastered. Yep. She lived in Switzerland for many, many years as a CCTV correspondent. Yeah. She knows the West. She knows the West well. She obviously knows her own country and civilization well. And she's a very interesting person to talk about substantive things, about the differences between the West and the East, the strengths and the weaknesses of both. And her excitement about the future of the CGTN world, which I felt like a peasant boy. They got more money than God, Don. I mean, wow.
Yeah, it's an impressive organization.
Know, again, that's trying to impress the visitor, the guest. But my eyes were wide open and my jaw hit the floor quite a few times. Like, wow, you guys have a nice setup here. But it's really how they pitch it, I still think they need to get in their stride. Of course, I'm talking about a competitor right now, but I'm sure they will get there. It's a cadre issue. They need to hiring people in the West to work for them is not an easy task, as I think everyone would well understand.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, for me, first of all, you know, I got up this morning. And some folks may know that are in the audience, I do a 3-hour news magazine every morning. It's sort of a compilation of programs from different media sources around the world, including RT and Sputnik and CGTN and others. And CGTN, for our listeners that aren't familiar, is China's global television network, and it's the successor to CCTV. And I was fortunate enough, when I went to Havana this past December, I was introduced to a guy who, through a mutual friend, it turned out, named Frank Contreras, who is the Western Hemisphere guy for CGTN. He's based in Mexico City. And they had, when they were covering Fidel Castro's funeral, they had like this huge suite in a hotel in downtown Havana as a base of operation. You know, MSNBC and these other characters are working out of pickup trucks and stuff. I was really impressed with that. But the thing about this morning, I'm assembling my program, and I saw your name, and I said, oh, well, because I was planning to speak with you in the next couple of days anyway, as your schedule would allow. And I said, wow, he's on CGTN. And I watched it, and just the image gelled in my mind as you guys were talking of this new global information infrastructure in terms of media conglomerates, in terms of sort of a hybridization of the personal side of the internet kind of based media and the old style networked media, that this is rising. And it's not just, you guys even had a conversation about the word alternative media, that in fact, this is a media that's rising, that's native to half or more of the population of humanity. And it's remarkable because it's not under the control of the same small group that's controlled the media in the West pretty much for the last 120 years.
And this is one of the things we discussed in the debate, which I really pressed hard, is that everything, well, virtually everything, a great deal of what we in the West, what they learn about the outside world is always mediated through the filters of this intensely small circle of concentrated media. And I said, we need to really break out of that. The countries collectively and the sympathetic countries, we have the resources to do this. So instead of going through New York and London to learn about, you know, for me living in Russia, for me to learn about Brazil, why do I need to go through New York, Los Angeles, and London to learn about Brazil? Okay, well, we need to be able to talk to each other directly without the filter. Because, you know, me going to Beijing, it's still filtered by what I have come across because I work in media. I have to study media. And so you can't help but absorb that. And then I get there and then I realize, wow, a great deal of what I've been told is just absolutely false.
Right.
And if it, you know, it happens every single time. What's happening in South Africa? Well, I'm going to make much more of an effort now because I think I'll go there next year. Because I'm going to talk to these colleagues in South Africa and give me a better picture of what's going on, because the filter is always through New York. And for me, that's very important. I think I created a sense of excitement, and I actually had dinner with our colleagues that were at the debate, and we were able to sit down with the head honcho, the main man at CGTN, which was and by the way, the meal was just extraordinary. And you know, he was very open. We talked one on one. We were there for like an hour and a half. You know, we were filling our gullets, but the food was great. But the conversation was even better. And Lu Xun was sitting right next to me, and we were talking about how we have to break this monopoly. And I even went as far as to say, is that you guys, we in the BRICS, we like to crunch numbers a lot, you know, with the population, GDP, growth. And I said, you know, that's all nice and fine, you know, but it's the information war that we have to win, because we can crunch all these numbers and people will never hear about it. I mean,
that's right.
This is the pathetic thing, and really the great opportunity. Because that is what RT has done. I've said this many times to many people, is that I don't know what RT's secret is, but I know the failings of Western media. And I think, you know, connect those two dots, and you'll see why these alternative newsletters are going to start to pick up traction. You have to have quality programming. You have to have intelligent conversation. I mean, RT, when we first went on air, I thought we were like high school TV. And now I look at our graphics, our computer graphics, and, you know, we can whip anybody on the block now.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, you got some nice
CNN
stuff.
And Fox hardly invest any money into their computer graphics. And, you know, presentation is important. Let's never forget that. And they're just resting on their laurels, and they're foolish, because their numbers are not Fox for different reasons, but the rest of the liberal corporate media, they are all without exception in trouble.
Yeah, financially, I mean, whatever numbers are published and available show that they're really in pretty sorry straits, actually. You know, in terms of all of that, everything having been mediated through, you know, this very concentrated group of Western media outlets, it's interesting that RT was able to, it's been the last two presidential elections that I'm aware of now, and really three, in that they in 2008 they at least covered the Green Party some, but in 2012 and 2016 actually holding third party debates that, you know, televised this. None of the American media outlets would give them any coverage at all, let alone give them 2 hours or, you know, 2.5 hours or whatever for debates like RT did. So that people who were looking in record numbers, really, outside of the two most despised candidates in the history of elections in the United States, for an alternative, had to go to Russian media for that information. And rather than saying, well, what is it that's wrong with American media that they aren't covering it, they're looking at this, televising of this and trying to impute motive to the, why are the Russians doing this in the first place?
And we end up in an intelligence report, a 25-page intelligence report that was put out in January of this year. 25 pages, a few pages were blank, and 7 pages were devoted to RT. I mean, what the hell is going on?
I know.
I couldn't believe it. I thought I was in the Twilight Zone. I just couldn't fathom how we could make it into an intelligence report. They reported on Occupy Wall Street. They reported on third parties. They reported on fracking. Yeah, because the major networks wouldn't do it, okay? And people are interested in those issues. Let me give you another example for our listeners.
Yeah.
A few years back, there was an award that was being given to Edward Snowden, for being a whistleblower. And this organization, it's not funded by the Russian government. It's some organizations in the West, I think in the UK, invited very well-known whistleblowers and critics. And one was Ray McGovern, a good friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And he was brought in. He did a live discussion in the news studio with other whistleblowers that had been brought in. And then when it was over, and they said, you know, cut mic, and the segment was over. And I went up to him, and he grabbed me, and he said, why in the world are we here as Americans in Moscow being part of an organization rewarding whistleblowers? He said, Peter, you and I remember the Cold War well.
I know.
I said, yeah, that's the sign of the times.
It's so heavily ironic for people that grew up when we grew up. I mean, it's the same thing for me. And not only that, I visited the Soviet Union in 1990. It's funny, I was speaking with somebody about this morning and talking about how far the media has come in Russia. So I'm in, admittedly, it was a youth hostel. It wasn't a luxury hotel that I'm staying at in Moscow, Gostanitsa Molodozhnya, okay, youth hostel.
Okay, I know it.
So I'm in there, and on television, the TVs are these little plastic jobbies up on the, you know, the dresser, the top of the dresser, whatever. Four channels. Three of them, there's a tractor on, and on the fourth one is a guy playing an accordion. That was Soviet television. That was the big, scary propaganda machine we were supposed to be afraid of that was going to talk us into human slavery and all this other crap that we were raised on. We fast forward to now, and if I want to see what the Green Party and the Constitution Party and the, you know, whatever other parties outside, libertarians, et cetera, outside of the Republicans and Democrats, who were totally owned by corporate America, by Wall Street, if I want to see that, I got to go to Russian television. To me, that's so ironic. And it's too bad I couldn't tell people back then that this is how things were going to turn out, because they would have understood how things actually were back then.
Or think about it in these terms here. I've been told to my face that nobody comes on you, nobody with a name comes on your program, nobody with any dignity or pride would go on RT. And I just turn around and say, Philip Giraldi, former counterintelligence officer in the CIA, Ray McGovern, former CIA, a person that read the morning cables, intelligence cables to three different presidents.
Right.
Three. Sitting in
what
the
an outlier.
Office.
He's an outlier.
And, I just go on and on and on. And it really, what it has become, and what I'm really proud of, is it's become a station where there's dissidents. And it crosses the entire spectrum. The entire spectrum. I am probably the only conservative a personality on RT, but there's a lot of moderates and there's a lot of progressives. Okay,
yep.
We cover the gambit. Even Tucker Carlson said RT is too left wing. I love that he said that, because that is a nuanced view. Meaning there are views there. It's just not someone reading a communique from the presidential administration. Because Believe me, if we ever did that, no one would have ever heard of us, because it's boring. It's tractor news, just like you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that's interesting about this, you know, we're looking at, say, markers of, legitimacy, I guess, because, again, the Western media doesn't look at any other media outlets as legitimate. People say things about that, about your program, for example, that you only have, you know, nobodies on, and et cetera, et cetera. And that RT is the same, and that Sputnik is the same, and they use Boris Badenov accents and Natasha to critique it. On the one hand. The other hand, the reality is you got 5 billion hits on YouTube. It's more than any other media outlet in the world, by far. You also have, you're sitting with the head of CGTN the other day. You know, if the guys at NBC sitting with the Cumes in their lap on Madison Avenue here in New York City, they're lucky if they draw 100 million people or 200 million, you know, pairs of eyes to a program. They're orgasmic. He regularly has a 500 million to 1 billion viewers there in China, just in China, before they even get outside the country. I mean, on the scale of it, the potential, it crushes the Western media, really.
Anytime on Crosstalk we do a program on China, it really does well on YouTube. And we did one on China a few months ago, and we got something like 160,000 clicks, which, I was really stoked. I thought, we really did well. Well, apparently CGTN translated the entire episode, and it played in China. It got 19 million hits.
Whoa!
19 million.
Wow.
And it was really funny, because one of the young producers of the debate that we did with the other BRICS countries, she was taking us to our taxi, and she turned to me and said, "Oh, by the way, did you know that your program got 19?
That's
it was just
amazing.
Off the cuff." And I just said, "What?" Anya, my editor,
yes.
She too was really struck. She said, "You got to be kidding."
I know, it's
and
amazing.
I told that to my boss today. He couldn't, and he's a sinologist.
Yeah.
He knows China very well. Mm-hmm. And that really spooked him. He said, really? And I said, yeah, that was just in China, the world.
Here, let me translate you telling him that into Russian. The way you would say it is, boss, I got 19 million hits I want to raise. That's how I would translate it. But, you know, what's interesting, I was at the Left Forum this past summer, and I was meeting a friend in a cafe in the middle of John Jay College. It was like a little Starbucks kind of joint there. And it was packed with people because they had let out for lunch at the Left Forum. So there were hundreds of people squirreled into a space that usually handles dozens. And I walked through the crowd. This kid in his 20s grabs me on the shoulder and spins me around and says, "You're Don DeBar." He said, "I've seen you on Crosstalk." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah, I live in Afghanistan." I was like, whoa. It's amazing the reach that network has.
It's funny. Well, maybe some people remember. I don't remember which iteration of YouTube it was. It was maybe like even almost 10 years ago. But there was a time that they would give. There was a bar on the page where you could hit for geographical views. Who is watching it in the world? And it would be different levels of intensity of green, and I would go and check. It was early months, actually, for Crosstalk. And I kept noticing that Afghanistan was really, really green. And so I was sent there to interview President Karzai. And on the way back from the interview, I was with some Russian journalists. And they said, "Peter, I know you want to get back to the hotel and you want to get out of this country." And I said, "Yeah, I really do." And he said, "I have to interview the head of NATO. At their headquarters." He said, "Would you mind coming with us?" And then he kind of sheepishly looked at me and said, "Would you mind doing the interview?" And I said, "Oh, come on. This is Russian media. You guys should do it. And that shouldn't be me. It's not about me." And they said, "Really? Could you please do it?" And I said, "All right, fine." And so they bring us into the maze. I mean, it was like Game of Thrones, okay? Oh, I mean, the security checks were just unbelievable, which I kind of, inside, I thought, well, maybe I'm safe here because there's so many precautions. But I'm eventually brought into the headquarters, and it was like this big prefabricated castle. It was like like Lego. Yeah. And I was brought into the general's office. It was a British general. And I was going down the corridor. I was in his reception room, and I was going down the corridor to his office. And he opened up his door, and he said, "Peter Lavelle, you should be more fair to us." He said, "Oh, everyone watches you here. Everyone. Even they admitted it. Everyone
watches it." That's amazing. That's amazing. That's some funny. That's really hilarious. So, you were at the BRICS conference. That was the reason for being in China, right? And give us a little background on some of the things that you saw there. That, I mean, you've been following BRICS for, you know, since its inception, pretty much. And we have, too. It'd be interesting to find out, like, what you saw happen this year that you know, in terms of developmental stuff, that this is coming along fine. Things that looked like innovation, like, gee, I never saw them do that before. Whatever caught your eye.
Well, I think I really was a bit of the odd man out, I must admit. And I think I know why. Because all of the representatives of the other countries, they are of the countries of the BRICS. And I am not. I'm an anomalous situation because I'm an American working in Russia.
Right.
And I kept cautioning them. My impression is that all of you want to mirror G7. And I said, that's a mistake, because G7 is essentially one size fits all. You follow the hegemon. And I said, there's no hegemon in BRICS. It can't be. OK, with China and India in the same organization, you think one's going to allow the other? And I said, that's good, because we have to get away from this Western concept of one size fits all. I mean, basically, the American exceptionalism believes that everyone deep down wants to be a liberal Democrat, okay? And we'll all eventually sing global kumbaya. I don't believe that. It's wrong. There's no evidence to support it. That is an ideology. That is a messianic ideology. I said, we have to be the pragmatists. And being pragmatic, we have to accept our differences. And they didn't like that. And I said, look at it from Russia's point of view. Russia had the Soviet Union, and it's one of the only instances that I know in history where an empire, the center, got less than the periphery. The center wasn't enriched. It didn't add to its power. And for me, as a conservative, communism in Russia was extremely damaging to its culture. Even its physical culture was destroyed unbelievably. It's remarkable how much is still left, considering the assault on Russian culture and religion, by the way. And so I was trying to talking to the head of CGTN, he was really curious about this because I said, let's not make the same mistakes as the West in building their institutions. We have to build institutions in parallel to the West and eventually have a world without the West. Okay. And it doesn't mean we don't have to accept some of their values, but what all of the countries that are in BRICS, except for Russia, were colonized or semi-colonized by the West. China was chopped up and weakened, but the others were colonies, and Russia doesn't have that colonial experience, so we don't have to overcome that. And so many BRICS thinking people think of the colonial legacy. I'm not saying you don't have to keep it in mind, but you have to think in different categories because for them it is to emulate the West, to be like the West. And I said that is a legacy you need to overcome. And we have to do it in a new way, and particularly with this intense globalization, the West isn't taking the environment seriously enough. We in the BRICS, we have the resources. We have to rethink global warming and global climate change completely. And I kept stressing to them, we have the resources to do this. We can't say we don't. Collectively, we can do that, and we can lead on these issues. And I also said, we have to stop. Don't go into the political realm so much. Let's go into people to people. Let's stay with culture. Let's stay with trade. And that will help dictate what the political conversation should be. See, this is what G7 is. It's all about, an ideological approach, and then you percolate it down. I say we have to do the opposite, because if we focus too much on politics, that's where we will find differences. For goodness sake, Don, the day before we started the debate, China and India were at loggerheads. I mean, we didn't think they were going to show up, okay?
Yeah.
Because of that border dispute.
Yep, I know. Yeah, so.
And I said, this organization shows its strength because of the organization. And we have to stress that. So I was helped with the conversation because all the other BRICS countries kind of began to understand what I was talking about. Don't emulate. Don't copy. We have to be innovative. And with the lack of leadership in the West, we have to be innovative now more than ever.
Yeah. And I just want I've only got about a minute and a half left, but you point out something that's even been exacerbated over the last couple of years, that there are contradictions within BRICS. You've seen, for example, Brazil has been swung with a coup there, the government change over the last year and a half there. South Africa has been in turmoil, which stabilized some. India and China have some serious contradictions, almost a shooting war the last couple of weeks. And yet, it's in their common interest to work together on some of these global problems. And it seems like the awareness of that is really coming to their consciousness, that they seem to be knowing that they can't let these other problems get in their way. Is that your sense?
Yeah, I mean, what I said, it was in private conversations. I said, look, either we deal with these issues, trade issues, climate change, how to deal with globalization, of course, dealing with media, we can do it together, or we can all individually make compromises and fold in the face of power. Now, I would rather be sitting next to you in dealing with the West and dealing with these issues than having each one of us picked off, okay? Right. And those differences that we have would be exasperated. So, and they understood what I'm saying. I said, I think you might have seen I put on Facebook after Trump's election. I said, none of us are going to get everything we want. We should be pragmatists and hope to get some of what we want and respect others at the same time. Yep. And I think that's what the BRICS philosophy should be, because this is a very important a conglomeration of interests and countries need to start leading, because the world is leadership right now, leaderless right now. And we're in a very, very dangerous time. And I think that the common collective wisdom of the BRICS moment that I call it. It's going to come to fruition. It's happening before our eyes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.